Welcome to Your Money Today, a unique look at financial, geopolitical, and other news relevant to you. For 45 years now, your host, Chris Temple, has provided his one-of-a-kind insights and advice on the markets and on our world. Whatever the subject, he calls them like he sees them. Roll up your sleeves with Chris as we get into today's program.
Welcome back, everybody. It's hard to believe, but yet another year has flown by, and I'm recording this a few days before Christmas, so Merry Christmas to all of you out there, and a happy and blessed and prosperous new year to come. What we're going to do today is recap the old year, or about to be old year, and doing it pretty much in line with my theme that I started the year with, where I said, let's do the math. President Trump, of course, was coming into office for the second time, only the second president in history to serve two terms non-consecutively, and with all different kinds of promises and so forth. And we're not going to be overly partisan in this analysis, and that was really the point of this year's theme. Whether you like Trump or hate him, whether you have the Trump derangement syndrome strain of TDS or the Trump deification syndrome of TES, and yours truly has neither. The question is, what do the numbers say? What is realistic when you get underneath all of the bravado and hyperbole and political wrangling back and forth and all the rest of this kind of a thing? And not many days hence, you're going to be seeing an updated podcast that is going to present my 2026 theme. That will be both an audio and video version, the video being because I will have a multitude of graphs and charts and whatnot that I'm going to want to share with you. And of course, the 2026 theme, in a way, is going to be a takeoff from 2025 and pick up where 2025 is leaving off, especially with a lot of things where the math did take hold in some of the markets and areas where it yet has not taken hold, namely, and near the top of the list, markets that are still priced for perfection, priced for all of the promises of President Trump coming true, and at the same time ignoring the math of lingering high inflation and lingering high borrowing costs, which are going to be felt much more so, I think, when 2026 comes along. So 2026 is going to be a little bit more of an acute theme, if you will. Essentially, in the working title, basically, and it'll end up something close to this, is 2026, will it bring us a golden age or an epic bust? And truly, there are arguments on both sides of that, where the golden age argument is concerned, at least the possibility, if all goes well, mostly for President Trump and the Republicans heading into next year's midterms, if we can get through this next year without anything like an epic bust or some fashion of a much more prolonged comeuppance in the markets. It has a couple of times this year tried to rear its head, but keeps getting pushed off. Now, a crucially important part of all of these analyses that we do of the markets is necessarily based on the math of our fractional reserve banking system itself and the underlying dynamics, the underlying nature of the very system in which we live and operate, which most people never take the time to really analyze. And the reason we do it, and I'm going to have an updated version of my most famous signature essay, if you will, Understanding the Game, early in the new year, a video version of it with a lot of updated charts and graphs and so forth. You need to remember that when we're talking about policy, we're talking about new industries, we're talking about debt and deficits and economics and stuff like that, presidents don't come into office in a vacuum. There is already a preordained, in many respects, fate that they experience. And when I laid out this year's theme just about a year ago, and I actually did a lot of this right after the president got elected and even before he was inaugurated, and then just before the inauguration, when I wrapped it all up in my Let's Do the Math discussion, I pointed out that no matter who had gotten elected, whether it was Trump or whether it was Kamala Harris, that they were going to be facing the most uphill fight of any president since at least Bill Clinton in 1993, if not Jimmy Carter when he took office in 1977. And in both of those cases, presidents came into office and were immediately saddled with what had preceded them when it came to interest rates and when it came to debt, and in Carter's case, when it came to the pretty much free fall of the U.S. dollar in the 1970s after we were taken off the gold standard. I have said a million times that Jimmy Carter is the president with the worst bum rap of my lifetime, because history to this day, and they even teach this in economics courses in college, blame him largely for the inflation and high interest rates and malaise and all of that stuff in the 1970s, when those things were actually mathematically unleashed by Nixon and Nixon's Fed Chairman Arthur Burns. And we were actually starting our second major wave of inflation by the time Carter was sworn in. In the case of Bill Clinton, when he took office in 1993, his main political hatchet man, James Carville, very famously said at the time that he always thought that if he came back to life, if reincarnation was true, he'd want to come back as a Pope or a 400 hitter in baseball or something like that. But he had changed his mind. He wants to come back to life as the bond market because he'd be able to intimidate everybody. Because Bill Clinton, to a very great extent, when deficits and debt still mattered at least somewhat in the 90s, a lot of his program was upended. He was yanked to the center on economic and tax and budget policies by circumstances, not just by the Republicans when they came in the election of 1994 and had resounding victories in the House especially, but the bond market dictated what Clinton was going to be able to do. Likewise, the president who is going to take office this year, and in this case it was Donald Trump, is facing a very historic latest peak in the credit cycle. And I've explained many times, and attached in the notes to this podcast will be a link to one of the easier and more understandable articles I've written on this. I've talked before about how Paul Volcker, who was remembered most widely, of course, as you all probably know, for having vanquished inflation and interest rates and all of that stuff in the late 70s and early 1980s. He brought interest rates down after jacking them way up to kill inflation off, etc. His second act as Fed chairman, which was far more consequential for what we're dealing with today, is very little understood and very little remembered. But in short, he turned a traditional business cycle into a credit cycle. So once upon a time, what this means, folks, is that the organic economy was its own living organism. And Federal Reserve policy, loosely, would be just a mild governor on economic policy getting too weak or too strong, but otherwise leave the economy alone. And Paul Volcker turned that upside down and created the world we live in today, which is why everybody obsesses over every word and syllable that comes out of a Fed chairman's mouth in recent years. He made it so that Fed policy and credit creation is the beginning of economic activity by and large. And so we have a credit cycle that affects business rather than the opposite, which we had for pretty much all of the years prior to that. What that means is, and what that has led to, are times when credit creation gets too silly and is too unsustainable and does not have sufficient backing in the Main Street economy, and something happens to where things unravel for a while. You had a big market event in 1987 when the dynamics that Paul Volcker had unleashed and had just recently handed off to Alan Greenspan got out of hand, and you had about a 40% drop or so in the stock market, which took about a year to right itself. That didn't have as much of an impact on a broad economy. You had a couple of examples of that in the latter 1990s, more centered outside the U.S. in Asia and Russia and so forth, with currency crises and debt defaults, and that had ripple effects here, but it wasn't centered in the U.S. The first biggie, of course, was the dot-com bust in 2000. Later on, we had the bigger bust that had a much more dire impact on a broad economy, and that was the 2008 global financial crisis. And since that time, there have been a few minor busts where the credit cycle blows off some of its steam. But what happened, as we all know now, back when the COVID pandemic started, is that that really gave the Fed at the time, under the most recent and still current Fed chairman, Jerome Powell, the ability to go apeshit more than ever before in history in printing money to keep all of the areas of the credit markets from busting that we're ready to. Because don't forget, in late 2019, and I've referred to this recently, with the Fed surprisingly having to trot out QE again at its most recent meeting, removing the limits with which it has previously been constrained as far as its repo market activities. Folks, there was already back in 2019, as there is right now, cracks emerging in global markets, and that was causing the Fed to have to shovel money into repo markets and things like that to maintain the appearance that everything was still okay, the central banks are in charge, and so forth. Back in 2019, Powell called this a plumbing problem that the Fed had discovered and had to start shoring up. And of course, they were able to shore it up big time when COVID came about, was in the news, and then that gave them the excuse to print 30% or so of all of the dollars ever created in the history of this republic, or once republic, now I don't know what it is, inside of about 2.5 years. Now, recently the Fed has had to do the same thing because we're in the same, if not a worse, mess when you look at a lot of the cracks underneath the surface of Wall Street and the really, I think, false sense of security that Wall Street has given all of us. You look at all the cracks underneath that, and that's where we're at. So anyway, this is the landscape that Donald Trump started his second term in, with a credit cycle that was ridiculously overextended. And then, to make matters worse, in the more recent past, and as I've remarked recently in some of my other interviews and podcasts I've done with others, this has somewhat astonished me. In Japan, you already have a much more dramatic unwinding of all of this kind of thing and a rebellion on the part of the so-called bond market vigilantes in Japan, where long-term interest rates have gone from nearly nothing to now over 2% as of this last week in a 10-year JGB, the equivalent, of course, of our 10-year Treasury note. And in comparison to our rates and others, that doesn't sound like a lot, but you're coming from a place where even the 10-year debt in Japan not that long ago was negative yield. And what happens when now you've got this big spike in yields in relative terms? You've caused hundreds of billions of dollars of mark-to-market losses on paper for everybody that has borrowed JGBs. Now, if they want to replace JGBs, they're going to lose. Meanwhile, all of this money that was created in the last few decades that this game, this carry trade game, was being played, that was, you know, borrowed yen, hypothecated Japanese bonds, whatever, you multiply that money and you invest it in U.S. stuff, European stuff, South, whatever, you invest in damn near anything other than Japanese yen and Japanese debt. And now that is unwinding. It's what a few commentators recently have called a global margin call that has begun, and it's only going to start picking up steam even more. Japan, and this is what the Fed and the U.S. and President Trump potentially have to look forward to in 2026, that would tilt us in the direction of that epic bust and away from a golden age, or at the least maybe maintaining the status quo. And that is something that nobody has on their bingo card right now going into 2026. Not only will the Fed have to pause, but it may also have to do what Japan just did and raise short-term rates again to keep this global margin call from getting totally out of hand, and to keep the dollar's decline from getting totally out of hand, and so forth. So here again, this is the mess that President Trump came into, And it's not just in the markets where a lot of things are overextended. I mean, you've got record delinquency rates in commercial mortgage real estate again, now above the peak delinquency rate of the financial crisis. You've got the Fed, as I said, having to trot out a new round of quantitative easing. And where consumers are concerned, and of course, this is going to cause a lot of economic and political angst, I think even more so in 2026. I'm going to get to this toward the end when we talk about how the midterms may be shaping up and how a lot of the reality setting in is going to give us a different market environment, very much a two-way market environment, I think, in 2026. But you've got roughly, and people quibble over these numbers, a 60-40, 65-35, whatever split in the U.S. with a 60 or 65% of consumers living paycheck to paycheck. And the stress in their households and their balance sheets has been revealed for many months now by record delinquency rates in subprime auto loans, which had become a problem. There have been a couple of bankruptcies recently, nothing that has upended the banking system yet, but these are things to watch. You've got people stuck in their homes. You can't move if you wanted to. You've got an interest rate now. And now, finally, there's been a little bit of a beginning of a rollover of the big boom we had in real estate valuations nationally. Of course, some areas are different than others. We all know that. But consumers now are having a hard time using their home as an ATM machine because they're already tapped out and the valuations aren't going up anymore. You've got credit card delinquencies and things like that. So all across the board, you've got consumers who are stressed. So this is the math that greeted President Trump here in his first year of his second term. Markets that are choking on debt, consumers that are choking on debt, the whole planet choking on debt, not doing a whole heck of a lot to grow its way out of it. And that, of course, is why the president has pursued, along with some of his key economic team members, the game plan that he has. And in one sense, I get it, because the only way, I mean, look, we have gone, and you've heard me say this more than once, folks, we've gone as a world, and millions of American consumers are in this boat as well, from having debts that are unpayable, and as a matter of math, you know, who rightly believes that now, just looking at the U.S., for example, and this just happened, the total debt in the U.S. just hit $100 trillion. Over $38 trillion federal debt, you add in some state and local debts, public debt, private, you know, corporate debt, and so forth. You add it all up, $100 trillion. We just hit that ignominious mark. On percentage terms, we are now approaching China, which is something like 350 or 60% these days, total debt to GDP. That 300, I think it's 20% now for us when you add it all up. Now we've exceeded Japan when it comes to our debt compared to everything else. But to hear President Trump tell it, he has given us the greatest economy in the history of the solar system. His math is a little bit shady when it comes to investments. He claims $21 trillion of investments in the U.S., in part thanks to tariffs and using the leverage of tariffs and threats of tariffs to get more companies to invest into the U.S. or do whatever. That $21 trillion is not a realistic number, but some of it is, no question about it. And look, in a number of ways, the president has done a lot to encourage business in the U.S., to revive investment and so forth. And this is simply for the reason, and he has said this in so many words, Treasury Secretary Bessent has said it, most notably besides the president, and that is they all know that there's no way, no matter what, you know, political hyperbole you hear from time to time, we're not going to get rid of the deficit. We're not going to get rid of the existing national debt. It's going to continue to grow. Bessent, if you remember, had his 333 program when he first came into office as Treasury Secretary early in the year, one of those threes being the goal to soul run the economy hot and expand the tax base, that we'd get the deficit down to 3% of GDP instead of where it's been recently at much more than double 3% of GDP. But here the president, in a couple respects, has been his own worst enemy, as you all know, if you paid any attention to what's gone on all year. We had a fiscal year deficit for the year that ended on September 30th of just under $1.8 trillion. Fiscal year 2024, the last full one under President Biden, it was slightly over $1.8 trillion. So you had essentially a rounding error of about $40 billion that the deficit was reduced by in fiscal year 2025. Now, that was with some tariff revenue coming in, not everything. The numbers are to be believed and the president were to be able to keep his existing tariff policies, which is pretty much doomed, and we'll find that out for sure when the Supreme Court issues its verdict on the big case in front of it imminently, you'd be talking about $300 billion a year. In tariff revenue is what the legitimate projections are. So not these trillions of dollars of tariffs that the president occasionally says have come into the U.S., maybe $300 billion a year. Certainly helpful, but when you've got the better part of $2 trillion besides that, which, in case you've forgotten, earlier in the year when the president got enough people to pass his one big, beautiful baseball, hot dogs, MAGA, apple pie, and motherhood and the flag bill, that bill itself is a base case, folks, adds $20 trillion to the overall debt over the next decade. And this is going to go down, honestly, as one of President Trump's most colossal failures and missed opportunities. Because he, just like Ronald Reagan, who ran on a lot of the same rhetoric, you know, Reagan brought in the Grace Commission early in his presidency. President Trump brought in Elon Musk and Doge early on in his presidency. And in both cases, both presidents threw those efforts under the bus, never followed through on anything of substance that came out of them. And therefore, you know, maybe you remember we were going to all get Doge rebate checks. Remember, they were going to cut so much waste, fraud, and abuse and so many agencies and this and that, that we'd all get a check for that, just like we're all going to get a check for tariffs. Don't hold your breath on either one of them. But this is going to be one of the biggest things where the math defeated, and frankly, the swampers, Tim Burchett, the representative from Tennessee, is more aptly put it recently, the sewer of Washington. The math in the sewer won, and the president laid down without much of a fight. This is what he gets for having two rhino big government Republicans like Johnson as his House Speaker and Thune as the Senate leader, who have zero interest, really, when you get right down to it, in Trump's agenda. They claim to, but at least when it comes to spending and the size of government, forget it. And the biggest monstrosity that they passed recently of the defense budget, you know, almost $1 billion more for Ukraine, which I thought the president was going to get us out of. You know, $750 million or more for the government of Israel. All of this other money, I mean, over $900 billion total, more than the next, I don't know, 18 or 19, whatever it is, countries on the planet these days. So there has been a complete lack of seriousness. And it's going to come back and bite the president, because the biggest math problem that we're exiting 2025 with, and it's been a bane of Trump's existence, again, largely self-inflicted, is the bond market and the level of interest rates. You know, he's been carping, as we've all heard endlessly, that the Fed's not bringing down short-term interest rates enough. And if they bring down short-term interest rates, that'll make cheaper mortgages. That's completely ass backwards. If the Fed were to be too aggressive in lowering interest rates and revive inflation fears beyond what they already are and cheapen the dollar, which has been rallying until recently, mortgage rates will go up, not down. And this is one of the things that people don't understand is facing us in 2026. We may well, before we even get to the halfway mark of the year, see the 30-year and a 10-year treasuries exceed the highs that they've already put in. over the last few years. And if you remember, of course, a 10-year treasury was just about 5% on the button before it fluttered down. It's about 4.20 or thereabouts as I'm recording this, from this last week, 4.15 to 4.20 in that area. But the president completely absconding on his promise to rein in the size of government, the cost of government, at least to this point, is not helping him when it comes to his promise to bring all levels of interest rates down. And that's going to be one of the problems that the Fed and the new Fed chairman are going to have ultimately. And again, as I said a few minutes ago, nobody has on their bingo card the distinct possibility that it's going to take an interest rate hike at some point, perhaps, to keep the bond market vigilantes at bay. In fact, along with this podcast and some of the contexts that will be floating around out there, and otherwise, you're going to see the latest cartoon that I asked my great cartoonist of many years, Jerry King, to draw for me. It's a takeoff of the great Clint Eastwood Western, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, and tells you about how the players, the Fed, the bond vigilantes, and President Trump himself are going to figure into this whole thing. I think you'll find it funny. I was laughing when the idea hit me in the head a few days ago, and then I asked Jerry to whip up that particular cartoon for me. And the bond vigilantes are going to have a lot of fuel this year, not just the inability and refusal of Trump and the Republicans to rein in spending pretty much whatsoever in any meaningful way. And again, that's as of right now. Maybe they'll all get that religion this next year. Who knows? But keep in mind, too, and this is a theme that a lot of people have warned about for a while, where the federal debt itself is concerned, 2026 is going to be brutal. You've got the biggest whack of Treasury debt coming due in a single year ever. Over $8 trillion is coming due in 2026. Most of it at interest rates lower than even the short end of the Treasury market right now. Now, this is why, of course, the government has the game plan right now, based on what Secretary Bessent has been saying, that they're going to, it's going to be like, Uncle Sam is going to be the biggest payday loan vendor, customer ever, because they're going to do all this as short as they can get away with and as short as the market will let them get away with. And again, what's going to be sacrificed is the long end. And one of the things that's going to hurt, and I'll get to this in a minute when I talk about, the election's coming up next fall, this is going to hurt Trump and the Republicans a lot. When we get to election day, and if anything, mortgage rates are higher, car loan rates are higher, et cetera, than they are even now, no matter what the Fed does. And that's not going to sit well with a lot of people. So pretty much the only thing that the president has as far as an answer to this, and I'm not saying that this is irrelevant because it is going to help somewhat to the extent it's legit, and that is all of the ways in which he is trying to run the economy hot and use policy and tariffs and everything else to increase investment, increase building. There's been a lot of announcements, God bless him for this, of a variety of different kinds of companies that are going to have new or renewed plants in the U.S., that will lead to more jobs, that will lead to a broader tax base and better wages in some cases. That's all great. My concern, and I'm going to talk more about this when we get to the Golden Age or Epic Bust 2026 theme here in the coming days, is that this is very disproportionately based on what a lot of us believe, and a lot of smart people have pointed this out way smarter than me, is a lot of flim-flam when it comes to the actual level of investment in artificial intelligence that we're actually going to see. Is it going to be that dynamic for the broad economy, or has it simply raised expectations to even more unrealistic levels and led to more unrealistic bubbles in the markets? Now, we've already seen a few cracks in recent times, mostly with Oracle, which not that many months ago was being ballyhooed as a completely reborn company, and now is on the brink of bankruptcy. Its credit default swap premiums have completely blown out, and everybody is calling the bluff on Oracle. And how that has allowed the broad markets to stay elevated, I don't know. I'll talk about the stock market briefly when we get to where we're going to close this discussion. But anyway, IBM CEO very infamously said recently that when you look at today's cost, I'm reading from an actual article on this, it costs $80 billion to build and fill 1 gigawatt AI data center. So when there's been promises between OpenAI and everybody else of 100 gigawatts of generation and capacity that's going to be added in X number of years to come, he said that that implies roughly $8 trillion of CapEx that's going to be needed. And there's no way, he said, that the economic return is going to begin to justify that amount of CapEx going in. But the announcements of that amount of CapEx going in, and as I and others have characterized it recently, you've got this kind of a daisy chain of announcements. AI company A is going to invest X in AI company B. AI company B is going to invest X in AI-related company C. AI-related company C is going to invest in equipment company D that provides stuff for AI. Company D, therefore, is going to invest back in company A, etc. There's a lot of flim-flam going on here, and I think that this whole thing economically has been vastly overstated, as IBM CEO puts it, and it has more contributed to this crazy bubble. Keep in the back of your mind that whatever the, however many letters they all have after their name, and I was in that world once upon a time. I was an NASD registered principal by the time I was 20 years old. And you can take all of the required exams and continuing education and all the rest of this kind of stuff, but bottom line is almost everyone who is a broker or financial advisor or whatever, they're all keeping up with the Joneses. They're all following the crowd. And so I think one of the reasons we've seen limited blowback on all of this as we're winding down 2025 is nobody wants to show on their statement of assets or whatever when we get out of 2025 that they were defensive. January is going to be a different story. It's going to be interesting to watch as we get there. But anyway, the president wants all of these announcements to keep rolling out, and we're going to soon, it won't be trillions of dollars of investments, it'll be gazillions of dollars and so forth. He loves to, he's always the showman. He loves to exaggerate and get everybody excited and so forth. Eventually, there's got to be some reality to move in with it. Until we get to reality, another one of his game plans, he is worn on his sleeve, so I give him credit for honesty, that he wants a weak dollar. He's defended the idea of a weak dollar, which he says will let us all get even more rich and help to pay down the debt by cheapening the value of the debt. So here again, at least the president's being honest. To help him with this, they'll find ways to explain away inflation, the better than expected inflation numbers that came out recently. Even New York Fed President John Williams says don't believe that because of the government shutdown. A lot of statistics weren't added, and it really didn't go from 3.1 down to 2.7%, so we're going to find that out soon. Well, even he admitted that the latest inflation numbers leave a lot to be desired. But the president, he's been toying with a few different names for a replacement as chairman for Jerome Powell when Jerome Powell's stint as chairman of the Fed ends in mid-spring coming up in 2026. If he leaves as scheduled, the Senate is presumably, and this is going to be a fun fight to watch no matter who it is that's picked, if the Senate confirms the new Fed chair nominee, Powell will probably just leave. I mean, that's customary on the part of Fed chairs, even if they have a remaining amount of time, as Powell does, through early 2028, being on the Board of Governors. Once he's down as chairman, he'll just resign and give up the rest of his term and let the president appoint somebody else. That's what the betting is right now. Who knows if it'll be that way. But the president, again, as I alluded to a minute ago, is taking an enormous risk, even if he's able to get somebody who is, pliable, as Arthur Burns was for Richard Nixon on and off in the 1970s. It's going to come back and bite him because inflation will become resurgent again. The bond market vigilantes will rebel. Long-term interest rates are going to rise. And again, you have to believe, if you look at history and look at the math here that's involved, that we are not going to have the accommodative Fed in 2026 that a lot of people are betting on right now. And this has been an ongoing thing. People just think that, you know, this endless credit is going to come with no cost, and that's just not going to be true to the same extent, at least in 2026. But, you know, you've got to at least give a nod to the possibility that Trump will be able to continue to sell everybody on the idea that it's all coming. You know, his nationally televised pep talk, 20-minute pep talk the other night, talking about how, again, we've got the greatest economy in the history of the solar system. He doesn't understand why voters don't get it, et cetera. You know, he might be able to keep these things going. We'll see. A lot of it's going to depend on some other forces. China, I'll talk about in just a second as we get to the back half now of this discussion. But look, there's a lot of stuff that can go right and keep at least the balls in the air long enough so that the Republicans aren't hurt too much in the midterms. But if any of it goes wrong, it is going to hurt everybody. You know, and let's talk quickly in that respect about tariffs. The math on tariffs was always contrary in reality to a lot of the fiction that the president was peddling. And look, I'm in favor of tariffs in selected instances where we are actually legitimately protecting U.S. industries. And if in those cases, they're worthwhile. In the instances where the president was using tariffs to try and even a playing field when it came to other countries' practices, I mean, a lot of people I don't think even knew, just to give you one of many examples I could, that a lot of European nations have had built-in tariffs literally since the end of World War II, where we are subsidizing their economies and their own businesses, presumably is, you know, part of helping them get on their feet, you know, the Marshall Plan, everything after World War II. Well, it's been 80 years. I think that and a whole lot of other things like NATO, a whole different subject we won't talk about today, and some other stuff need to be thrown away. But, you know, in those instances, fine. But one of the things that has hurt the president, and we all saw this in the oral arguments in his case before the Supreme Court, which again, he is almost certain to lose, and I explained that in the National Investor a couple issues ago. You have instances where, you know, what kind of an emergency is it that justifies the emergency powers he claimed, where he increases tariffs specifically on Brazil because he doesn't like the way Brazil is treating former President Bolsonaro down there, nor do I, for that matter. But what did that result in? Instantly, coffee doubled back in the spring. Bananas, other fruit, some beef imports, other stuff got more expensive. And recently he had to run up a white flag and say, okay, I give up, you know, I'll remove those tariffs because now I'm the affordability president. And that elicited a funny comment I saw on social media where, you know, Trump adding those tariffs, raising prices, and then, you know, taking them back is kind of like the equivalent of getting carjacked, and then the carjacker offers to give you a ride home. And it's not selling well with the public, okay? And I want to segue into that really quick before I talk about some specific markets and wrap this up for at least for today. You know, a Fox News poll came out this last week, and one of the encouraging things for the president or for the Republicans on Capitol Hill showed that 59% right now of the people in this country are not satisfied, but that is down from 68% who were unhappy right after the election last year. So year over year, you had 68% negative outlook overall on the country by registered voters. Now that's down to 59%. Still a troubling number, but not as bad as it was. The approval of satisfied reading went from 31% last December to now it's 41%. So things have gone somewhat in the right direction. And thankfully for President Trump and the Republicans, if you're on that team in the House and Senate this year, the Democrats, as I mentioned earlier on the budget and a lot of things, President Trump being his own worst enemy, he hasn't done as much damage to himself, I think, in many respects, as the Democrats have to themselves. I mean, their brand is so out of favor that they're probably, they, you know, look, in a midterm election, it's usually customary that the party that has the White House loses seats. That's just the way it is. Doesn't matter, you know, and there's only been a couple exceptions to that in the last century or so, really, when you go back and look. But if the Republicans somehow manage to avoid the math on this, it's going to be because the Democrats are so hapless. I mean, I don't know what's going to happen yet. I've got a few hunches depending on how things turn out. On this subject, one of the ways in which the president really needs to understand that he needs to pivot in a lot of his messaging is to not continue to tell two-thirds of the population that living paycheck to paycheck, experiencing inflation rates still very troubling to them, even as he claims that prices are all coming down. They aren't, okay? He better get with a program and understand that he is insulting and making himself a joke to, again, about two-thirds of the population, if not greater, that understands that living costs are continuing to go up. I mean, I've used the example recently, and some of you may remember this, and it was really something that George Bush Sr., when he was president, was beaten over the head with repeatedly. And if you remember, he went out with some of his entourage to a grocery store and had never at that point in time seen before the modern day electronic cash registers. You know, he's used to the old cash registers where you ding, ding, you know, the door opens and, you know, the person has got to be at least somewhat fluent in math. You know, the checker, the whoever it is that's running the cash register, be able to make change and so forth. Now all of a sudden this is kind of computerized somewhat. And he was amazed at what this is. And it turned into a joke, probably overdone in retrospect, but it showed that he was out of touch and he just doesn't experience things like Joe Sixpack and Sally Soccer Mom and Uncle Fred and Aunt Martha, who were the retirees and so forth. Likewise, President Trump recently has just been completely out of touch with the average Joe Sixpack and Sally Soccer Mom today when he repeatedly insists that all is well when in their mind and in, according to their pocketbook, it's not. Okay? That's problem number one. I mean, look at recently here when and again, all the statistics, I don't care if it's Republicans or Democrats in office, they all massage the numbers, they all lie because it helps them feather their nest. All right, well, Peter St. Ives, good friend of mine, many of you follow him on social media, great economist, great pundit. You know, we had a great time visiting in New Orleans recently at when we were both at Brian London's New Orleans Investment Conference. But he put out something recently that helped to explain how the consumer economy is not that great. He pointed out Black Friday this year, sales were reported to be up 8% year over year. Problem was, it was pretty much all inflation. All right. And he also pointed out something that the Trump administration will leave out of statistics like this. And that is buy now, pay later stuff jumped to 20% of all spending. And just recently, as he put this out, half of the people have already missed their first payment on this. So here again, this is something that can't go on forever. It's caused by inflation. It's caused by high crushing levels of debt already. And, you know, I think even more than just the president's overall comments on, you know, inflation's all a figment of your imagination. I don't know why people don't love me and why you don't want me to be on Mount Rushmore along with renaming the Kennedy Center for me and all the rest of this stuff. About all he can come up with for affordability is trotting out his asinine position recently. Well, we need 50-year mortgages to make houses more affordable. I mean, that went away real fast and for good reason, because that was such a stupid thing to have said, economically and politically both, and which is why you're not hearing about it now. Now, all of this preceding said, let's wrap it up into the political and economic landscape, and this will be a bit of a preview of the coming talk on this for 2026 and what the math suggests will continue from this year and or change from this year where different markets and asset classes are concerned. And we're going to take a lap through a lot of the key investment stories, good, bad, and indifferent, over the last year, where that goes. First of all, and I alluded to this earlier, one of the reasons why the markets have held up despite interest rates being sticky, besides inflation being sticky, besides a lot of the economic and debt reduction promises not being kept and so forth, is because between what is real and what is fantasy, the markets have been willing to give President Trump the benefit of the doubt and believe that he's going to pull off this massive increase in investment, this massive increase in the tax base and in wages and all the rest of this kind of thing, even though the evidence to date as we finish 2025 on all of that is mixed at best. What's going to change things and this equation in the year ahead will be that if more cracks emerge in the whole Trump shtick, and I don't say that necessarily as a negative term, but this whole narrative. And the biggest thing for that, of course, is going to be if all of a sudden it looks like Republicans are in really serious trouble for the year coming up. And repeating something I said earlier, in a certain extent, I think that if Republicans do lose, it's not only due to the fact that this is kind of customary. It's just the way things work in our political system, where voters are flighty. They go back and forth and don't give anybody a chance sometimes, even people who deserve it. And I believe that the Trump agenda, more ways than not, deserves some greater support on the part of the population. I don't want to seem overly negative here. I think that the president has done a great many things where crime, our national security, our borders, and so forth are concerned. The Democrats weren't going to fix any of these things. President Trump has fixed a lot of these things spectacularly well. And I think it'll be a damn shame if we see a lot of that go up in smoke if the midterms turn out badly. But it's going to be up to the president to sell this whole thing. And again, to this point, on the things that matter most to consumers, and that's key, he's not doing a very good job. His approval is way down. Voters aren't interested in him supporting genocide in the Middle East. They aren't interested in him, even where Ukraine is concerned anymore, keeping us involved and spending more money on that, which he just, again, approved recently. Don't want to see us go and invade Venezuela or any of the rest of this kind of thing. As always, it boils down to bread and butter economic kind of issues. And on that, overwhelmingly, the voters are interested in inflation and high prices. In fact, here's another part of this recent Fox News poll out recently, where they looked at a whole bunch of different topics. 90% of voters stressed inflation and high prices. Again, if the president continues to, you know, downplay this, it's going to cost him and Republicans next year. Number two, 86% of people are concerned about the price of health care. You go all the way down the list. Actually, illegal immigration is at the bottom of the list that they were looking at. But again, the top two things, inflation and health care. And health care, of course, is a mixed bag depending on who you listen to. There's no question that for a lot of people next year, the cost of their subsidized health care is going to go up because of subsidies that the Democrats passed and planned to have sunset this year. That was all the Democrats doing. That's going away. And of course, they're trying to spin it that's the fault of the Republicans. To the extent anything is the fault of the Republicans, it has been that for, again, the latest time, that Republicans have insisted that they will give us a comprehensive fix to all of the things that are indeed wrong with Obamacare. They failed to deliver on that themselves. So that's going to be a ping pong ball back and forth of, you know, blame game this year. So it's not looking good right now unless the president can pull off a major sales pitch. You know, don't forget that in the 2018 midterms, the Republicans lost 41 seats in the House. That was more than usual. There's a lot of things that have changed since then. The president has broader support, I think, on behalf of the public on big picture things, as I mentioned a minute ago. and within the Republican Party itself, although he's not helped himself there either, because some of the truest believers of the MAGA cause are on the outs with President Trump, from Marjorie Taylor Greene, who decided that she's done, she's going to resign, effective in a few weeks. Thomas Massie, another House Republican who, as much as anybody, actually believes in the MAGA agenda. Trump has encouraged a few billionaires to oppose him and to primary him in the state of Tennessee. And look, he can't afford to drive away people who disagree with him, who prior were his most ardent supporters. God forbid, when it comes to the president and his political chances, if we see over some of these continuing foreign policy forays from a president who promised he wasn't going to do any of this, what if a Tulsi Gabbard who came on board, or Bobby Kennedy who came on board, at least in part, where both are concerned, maybe more so with Gabbard, over their vision, sharing Trump's stated vision on foreign policy? What if they leave and say, look, we thought this guy was one of us, but he's sucked up to the neocons again, huge defense budgets, getting us involved in all these foreign countries. And I think this, and this is again a separate subject for another day, folks, like with my crack about NATO a few minutes ago, the president suffers here from being too much of a pragmatist in ways, and also someone who will listen to the last person, basically, who buttered him up. Okay, so I'm going to dispense with that for now, by and large, except to point out one more thing that should scare the living hell out of Republicans right now. And that was, for those of you who are political junkies, the recent interview that his chief of staff, Susie Wiles, gave to Vanity Fair magazine. This is something that has alarm bells written all over it for President Trump's really enduring with any kind of good support. I mean, when was the last time that you saw a presidential chief of staff of a president, especially in this case, who wears, you know, you'd better be loyal to me, or I'm going to primary you, or I'm going to call you names, or whatever. How in the world does his chief of staff come out and besmirch Trump, besmirch J.D. Vance, and others, question his policy on tariffs when he's trying to tell us in his public utterances that if Supreme Court rules against us, they're going to kill the economy, and all the rest of this kind of stuff? These things don't happen by accident. And I've told a few of my Republican friends in discussions that we've had recently over the coming year that this is a shot across the bow to those who are, you know, who are looking to the midterms and to Trump having any meaningful amount of political capital by the time that we get there. I think that this stinks to high heaven. She should be fired, instead of defended now as she's being defended by Trump. Okay, Thomas Massie's not getting away with this. Marjorie Taylor Greene's not getting away with this. But the person closest to the president is getting away with this. And in a worst case scenario, this is going to be the beginning of a trend throughout 2026 where more and more Republicans are running to try and save their reelection chances by distancing themselves from a president whose own chief of staff now just took the first shot at arguably Trump's feet of clay to topple him. Maybe I'm overstating it, but there is no way in hell that this woman should still be his chief of staff. Again, I may be overstating some of these things. I may be overly concerned. I hope in more ways than not that I am overreacting to some of this. But the political landscape is not looking good in the times ahead, and that is going to have an impact on the markets, and among other things, it is going to cause the math, as I've been discussing it, to become far more relevant in the year ahead if all of a sudden Trump is seen to be much more damaged politically than chronically high inflation, sticky interest rates, the deficits. All of these things are going to start to matter a whole hell of a lot more. And I'm, of course, going to continue to talk about in the weeks and months ahead a lot of these same things and more. You're going to see a much more frequent presence for, thankfully, Your Money Today in a new year. We're going to do this. My objective is at least once a week. I've commented before that I have done this podcast sporadically during 2025 since kind of resurrecting this Your Money Today brand, because I do so much on so many else's, so many other people's podcasts, and which I'll continue to do. But we're going to do our own a lot more for a whole lot of reasons that will become self-evident as the new year unfolds. But that said, I'm going to go over a few things in the markets and economy I have already talked about fairly quickly to wrap this up. How did the math work this last year? How did it not work? What do I see for the next year ahead? And I'm keeping this short for a few reasons, number one of which I've already rambled a fair bit, I think necessarily to set up the broad themes that we're going to be looking at anew. But also number two, because in a lot of these cases, you're going to see a lot more focused work in the days ahead. During the holidays, I'll be finishing up or very near finishing up a few updated special reports, one on precious metals, one on energy, one on base metals and commodities, one on story stocks, as well as what I alluded to earlier, being a more official 2026 theme that will be probably the next thing you'll see, with a lot of charts and graphs and so forth, kind of picking up and expanding on parts of this discussion, but more focused on the different markets and things like that. And you're also going to see that remake of Understanding the Game, which will make all of it, I think, make that much more sense. But all of that said, I already mentioned my view that the stock market come 2026 is not going to be able to defy gravity any longer. Everybody needs to stay fully invested as we're ending this year, by and large. Maybe we'll see a little bit more selling pressure. 2026 is a new year, not only on the calendar, but also for what money managers, pension funds, ETFs, and everybody else have to show as far as their holdings are concerned. And again, my concern is for the broad markets right now that the president is going to be much more damaged politically and Republicans deemed to be in more trouble for the midterms coming up. That's going to start to bite as the year progresses. I don't know if we'll, you know, maybe beyond a knee-jerk overdue correction in January and February, as often happens, we right ourselves after that if the news doesn't get any worse. But I'm not, you know, wanting to be overly bullish on the stock market generally going into the new year. Precious metals are one thing that in 2025, as you all know, and a lot of you happily so, did respond to the math of chronically higher deficits and debts the world over. More money printing pretty much every place except an asterisk these days in Japan, etc. Gold hit records not only in nominal terms but in real terms, exceeding its inflation adjusted high finally from 1980. Silver is still nowhere near its inflation adjusted high, but has made a lot of noise in recent days by making new nominal all-time highs. And this again is as a lot of the math, where in silver's case, of supply is concerned. This kind of takes us back to the 2024 theme, supply, supply, supply. Silver is benefiting from this. A lot of the commodities that at least for a while were embargoed by China. Uranium, which we're overly dependent on Russia and its orbit for. A lot of these commodities, the math is very screamingly bullish longer term. I have much greater expectations going forward for copper and uranium than what we've already seen. Silver, you know, I'm ambivalent after this run. Long term, I love it as well as all commodities, but we have to be looking over our shoulder and prepared at least a little bit for what will happen to all of these stories if we see a broad decline in the overall markets because of one reason or another. Everything will get taken along for the ride with that, and with the, you know, resulting scramble for liquidity that investors will have to respond to. One of the commodities that's intriguing as we close out this year, where the math I think is screwed up but in a very different way, is the price of crude oil, which on a New York contract has been pretty much below $60 for a while now. It just reached its lowest since the worst consumption story during the pandemic a few years ago. Long term, oil is wholly unsustainable. At this level, we should be $70 to $80 minimum. to incentivize the kind of investment in replacement reserves and future production that is necessary, because we're starting to see production roll over. I mentioned a few minutes ago being at the New Orleans conference, and one of the interviews I gave to one of the media people that was there, I was asked the question of all of the different commodities and critical materials, what's your favorite critical material right now? And I said, well, I'll throw you a curve, because it isn't always characterized as a critical mineral in the context of those kind of discussions these days. But my favorite, frankly, is oil, because it's just too low. Positioning is way too bearish. And not for the first time in recent years, the rumors of its demise have been greatly exaggerated. I was happy that people like Rick Rule and others are chiming in basically on this very same notion. Rule announced, I think it was actually at that conference and otherwise since then, that he's taken profits, as we have in our portfolios, on some of the rare earths and other commodity and even some precious metals stuff that was, you know, went from being cheap to being at least fairly priced these days. Take some profits where you could, and move it, among other places, into oil, which is just ridiculously cheap. And when you look at the valuation of the energy patch, it's just stupid. And so we're doing a little bit more. I actually added one old name back to our list of a midstream company just in the recent past. A lot of this is, I think, because of the increased demand, which is going to impact more natural gas and even nuclear power. But to the extent that there is legitimacy and reality to some of these projections on how much more data centers and then AI are going to require as far as power generation, natural gas and nuclear power are going to be the two big winners in that order, as we have to provide more and more juice for all of this kind of stuff. Moving on, other math this last year that didn't go according to plan, at least by all appearances, is where China is concerned. China, just recently, it was announced, actually two things I want to focus on, and I'm going to have a separate discussion on China here in the near term also. Two things. Number one, for the first time in history, China's annualized trade surplus has hit $1 trillion. It's dropped slightly where the U.S. is concerned, but gone up where others are concerned. More so, and this is going to be a big development to watch in 2026 as well, folks, that could inform an awful lot of things. Every 5 years, as some of you know, China has their every 5 years game plan, where they sit down together and they map their broad economic and investment strategy. And keep in mind that China, and this is an impulse that still bears a lot of watching too, you know, you've got the continued inflationary impulse in the U.S., against a deflationary undertow still in China that they're valiantly fighting. They're fighting that much more than we're fighting our inflation impulse, I'll tell you that. And because of that, at their most recent, this last fall, five-year game plan and meeting, they actually doubled down on their export-led growth model. So while the U.S., among others, has browbeaten China, saying that you need to stoke consumption in your country to take some of your surplus production so you're not dumping it on the rest of the world, everybody seems to forget that by and large, the overwhelming impulse culturally in China is not to be a spendthrift like Western consumers, not to buy and or borrow money for more than what you need. So that's just a non-starter with the overwhelming majority of the population over there, and the leadership knows this. Now, surely in recent years you had a modest bump up in the percentage of the population that whose business and incomes have been westernized, and they are more consumptive, no question about it. A lot of the U.S. brands have wanted to, you know, set up shop over there to take advantage of that. But the big underlying story still is of a country that is much more frugal and responsible than Western countries and their consumers are. So what that means is that going forward, it's going to continue to exert stress on economies and trade relations and pricing, when China, with pretty much everything it does going forward, is going to continue to try and sell stuff at the cheapest price it can. you know, that harkens us back to, you know, the meeting a while back where President Trump and President Xi supposedly, you know, declared a truce, and each side stepped back from some of their worst things. But I got news for you. And Professor Steve Hanke is one of the smartest people out there. I follow him on Twitter/X, and he has put out a lot of stuff on this, among many other people, that, you know, one of the ways in which Trump's bombast has been most misleading has been over his assessment of this great deal with China. He had his ass handed to him, folks, among other things, to get a one-year reprieve on China's exports embargoes that they had on some rare earth magnets. All right, there are still embargoes on certain things from China. He's having to give better and better chips to them and so forth. But what he also did, which was very little covered, is that he basically pulled the plug on what was called an affiliates rule that U.S., and actually Biden enforced this somewhat, that the U.S. has had with China, okay, where it says basically the result of this is that there are some 20,000, according to Professor Hanke, previously banned Chinese firms that because of this truce are now allowed to re-enter the Western financial system. Okay, that means that they have more influence, not less, over U.S. financial structure, over corporations that they own a part of in the U.S., etc. And look, this is reality. And I don't necessarily blame Trump for this mess because he didn't create it. It was over a few decades, as we've discussed many times in the past, that the U.S. sold itself out to China and others, more so to the corporations who were greedy and wanted cheaper labor and cheaper production in places like China. That's where it all started, of course. So now we're at a place where China is going to continue to double down on their export model. It's going to continue to keep stress on trade relations and so forth. And how their president responds to this remains to be seen. You know, Treasury Secretary Bessent a while ago was threatening and saying, well, if China continues with its embargoes, you know, the whole rest of the world is going to join forces and rebel against them and build their own replacements for stuff. That's not going to happen right away. It's not going to happen during Trump's presidency. Bessent, among other things, claimed that we can replace all the rare earth magnets and whatnot that we get from China inside of 2 years. He said living in a fantasy world. That's just not going to happen. If we're lucky, maybe it'll take 10 or 12 years to do that kind of a thing. So, you know, this is still going to be a big thing going forward. Look, the president on a variety of fronts with permitting reform, some selective, and I'll have, a whole separate issue, actually a couple of issues probably on some of these subjects, with his selective investments in different projects, whether it's in Alaska, whether it's MP Materials, whether it's Lithium Americas, all these different things. Better than nothing. It's better than where we're coming from. But the math equation here has been grossly neglected still by President Trump, because we need way beyond everything that's been done and discussed to truly be able to get off of dependence on China for a lot of these things. I would love to see, and I had this conversation with a few people recently at the annual meeting of the American Exploration and Mining Association down in Reno. You know, if we spent or legitimately promised 10% of these phantom billions and trillions and gazillions toward AI, which is more a function of goosing markets and asset prices than anything real, if we legitimately had a way to commit 10% or maybe 20% of that to truly undergirding our own mining industries, all of the processing, all the downstream stuff, we could be on a more sure path to get ourselves off of dependence on China. But that's not happening, and it's not, unfortunately, it's not going to, by all appearances, in the year ahead. So we're going to be in a lot of trouble where that goes. And it's really sad that where the math is concerned on what is needed for investment, for job creation, for job training, for trade schools and the rest of it suffers, while all of the AI flim-flam and the various other means of simply stoking this phantom wealth and the Magnificent Seven stocks and so forth, you know, we're going to pay for this. And again, the problem is going to be, and this is going to add to a lot of negativity in the markets if these things start to unwind in 2026 and pretty much dooms the Republicans and therefore President Trump by the time the midterm elections roll around. And so finally, speaking of where doubling down is concerned, we're going to see the president continue to double down on his game plan to give us real or imagined or hoped for or maybe investment and proper economic developments and whatever sufficient enough to not only later forestall a disaster for Republicans at the polls next fall, but between now and then keep the markets afloat. The more that we push with these especially questionable, I'll use a polite term, game plans and promises of investment to try and force this golden age and get everybody to believe in it, get everybody to be all in with all of this free money and so forth that Trump wants us to have, thanks to a more accommodative Fed this year, which again may not materialize the way he thinks. You know, he hopes that's going to get us to a point where at least they manage to get through next year without a disaster. That increases the odds. They were evident, as I said at the outset, when he took office anew, and I think have grown since then, of all of this overhang of debt and the deficit, which again the president has done very little about, if anything. And will that allow him to even get by with all of this stuff for a second year, let alone blow up on him? So again, stay tuned. Not many days hence, you'll see in much more detail lots of charts and graphs and supporting stuff. And again, I'll be fair, both cases for what is legitimate that could eventually lead to a golden age, all else being equal, but the continued math that's going to work against the president this year and against the markets, I think, ultimately, that could, worst case scenario, lead us at some point to an epic bust. So anyway, thanks for listening. Again, Merry Christmas, Happy Holidays, and Happy New Year to you, and we'll be looking forward to our next time together.
We're glad you joined us today. As always, write to chris@nationalinvestor.com with your comments and questions. And be sure to visit yourmoneytoday.org if you haven't already. Sign up for our free alerts, notifications of new shows, and more. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next time.